Welcome to Agam the Climate Podcast, a literary podcast on climate and consciousness. As we grapple with new uncertainties, we bring you the voices of poets, artists, and scientists who find solace and strength in the imagination. I'm Padma Perez for the Agam Agenda. Join me as we reimagine the climate crisis through stories and art. Wang Xiaojun is a writer, journalist, language educator, translator, environmental activist, and social justice advocate. Xiaojun is from North China's Shanxi province, birthplace of China's civilization. Shanxi is currently the largest coal producer for the whole country. In this conversation, you'll hear about how Xiaojun witnessed the province's transformation by the coal industry and how this led him to advocating for kinder, low-carbon futures. Recently, he has also worked to center the stories of indigenous climate-vulnerable communities at the highest levels of policy and decision-making on development and climate change. Xiaojun, or Tom as he is known to friends, is a contributor to our forthcoming anthology of climate literature. And as you'll hear in this episode, Tom is a storyteller by heart. Hello, Tom. How are you?
Hi, Padma. I'm good.
Thank you for being here with us today. I'm excited to ask you about your contribution to the forthcoming Agam book. You wrote a very moving story about a girl growing up in a world of coal mining, and the title is Full Moon. Could you say it in Chinese, please?
Yes, it's Man Yue.
Full moon nights always seem to feel colder and quieter than other nights. It's probably because everything seems so clear and bright. Chinese people are fond of the full moon. Three of the most important festivals are set upon three full moon nights. After harvest and before the next year's farming season, between the 8th full moon and the 12th full moon, farmers in our village would go to work other jobs for money. Many of them went down a dark, narrow vertical tunnel into the mountain for a different harvest of black gold.
You're also from a part of China that produces a lot of coal, am I right?
Yeah, my hometown is part of Shanxi province, which is in central China. And Shanxi province produces one-third of coal for China. So it's pretty much the largest coal producer in the whole country.
And growing up there, what was that like? What did you witness or learn or experience on the story of Chinese coal miners and mining communities?
That's quite interesting because when I was very, very young, coal was not really mined a lot. I was born in the early 70s, and at that time, coal was a very big part of our life. We were burning coal to cook. We were burning coal in winter for heating. So it was everywhere. I remember going down the hill to actually help my mom carry coal back into our house for winter so that we could get heating. I grew up thinking coal as a very important part of my life. But then in the 80s, because we had so much coal in the province underneath the mountains, all of a sudden, I think that was also when China started opening up and also the economy started to grow. And there was all of a sudden a huge demand for coal. And my hometown just started to get a lot of both domestic people and also laborers from other provinces to work as coal miners. All of a sudden, basically overnight, my hometown became really noisy and very dirty. There were so many non-local people and so many trucks. And all of a sudden, there were a lot of different factories to process coal being built around. It was just such a change all of a sudden in the 80s. And that kind of like just changed the way I was looking at coal. Instead of something very necessary, it became something very dirty in my mind.
It was as bright as day, but as quiet as night, she would say. My crying, piercing through the crisp winter air and announcing my arrival to the world, was the only sound in our small village. Mother believed that I was calling for father, asking him to come home. It was the 12th and the last full moon of a year. 15 days after I was born, Mother and I celebrated my first Chinese New Year, just the two of us. Father never returned, not when that winter's last snow melted, not for the Lantern Festival, not for the Mid-Autumn Festival, and not for my first birthday or any birthdays.
That's an interesting shift in your perspective. And also from your story, I gather that the work of coal mining is not without risks.
Yeah, I actually have some relatives, some of my cousins who worked as coal miners, because at that time, compared with doing agricultural work or working for other factories, to be very honest, to begin with, there weren't many job options around in my hometown. So people were either farmers or they were working for the government, but that was only a small handful of people. Some of my cousins, when we later on became teenagers, some of them started working for the coal mines. And I remember quite clearly one of my cousins who actually had an accident inside the coal mine, and he broke his left leg. And the coal mine sent him to hospital. He lost his left leg. But then when he was discharged from hospital, he couldn't really go back to farming. And the only option for him was to go back to the coal mine. So for me, yeah, I mean, like many people say, coal mining and coal burning and coal chemistry made a lot of money for our province. But it was only the coal mine owners who had the money. But people like my cousin and people like me and my family, we never really, you know, like grew rich together with the province or with the coal mine owners. It is a very dangerous job, but at the same time, it's also a very kind of desperate way of living. It's just a lot of people's lives and people's families and their children, their wives and their parents being concerned, being worried, and being, you know, like so scared for their lives all the time.
It sounds like an awful bind to be in. And so what you're saying is that the opportunities haven't really changed from when you saw coal mining expand and boom in your home province?
Not really. At the beginning, people were excited about it because, relatively speaking, coal miners were making a lot of money too. They were making definitely more than a farmer would do. And there were more job opportunities because of the new coal processing factories. But very quickly, people realized that those were very dangerous jobs, and also that kind of economy wasn't really sustainable. I mean, nowadays, my home province is still one of the poorest provinces in all over China. So clearly, in the past 30-some years, coal mining and coal processing haven't really helped the province get rich. I'm really proud of my home province because people, when they talk about China, they say there's such a long history. And all of this history almost all started in my home province. Also, it's one of the richest provinces in terms of coal resources, but also in terms of history and culture. And I just remember very sadly how in the 80s and 90s, a lot of this, you know, temples, pagodas and grottos that had already been around for more than, you know, thousands of years were collapsing because coal mines underneath the mountains were just, you know, like getting the mountains empty. So the mountains couldn't even support the pagoda on the top. And the pagoda was all the way from Tang Dynasty, was just leaning to one side. It's not just people's jobs and people's lives. It's also thousands of years of culture and history that we are losing because of coal mining and coal industry. So, yeah, I mean, like coal industry hasn't really made our province rich, but at the same time, it has actually made the province poorer because it has taken away the heritage that we have got from thousands of years ago. And at the same time, it is taking away the future that people should have, because future generations could very easily make a living from tourism based on all this, you know, like long history and all the cultural heritage.
But if that's being destroyed, then the future will be without that heritage.
Right.
It was a black goat that had taken father, mother would say, locking our eyes and squeezing my arms. She wanted me to stay away from black goat. I did. There were times, I admit, when it was cold and dark, especially in winter, that I had wished I could burn some black goat. I didn't.
Speaking of the future, the world is very excited about China's pledge to cut carbon emissions by the year 2060. In the light of that, what kind of futures do you imagine for Shanxi?
The near-term future, for example, I mean, like before 2060, there's also the 2030 carbon emission peak commitment. So that's, to me, almost even more exciting than the 2060 neutrality promise, because that means in my province, immediately, the local government will get the signal that coal burning and coal mining must stop as soon as possible. And as the local leaders, they need to find new industries and new job opportunities for local people. So I think that that's even more exciting. The most important part also to me is that people from my hometown will live with dignity, because coal miners used to be looked down upon. And even me working in Beijing for almost 20 years, when I was telling people I was from Shanxi, the very first words that came to their mind was coal mines or coal pollution. So I think with this new change, people from my hometown can live safely, happily, and healthily. And also they can live with dignity. They can be treated as an equal, as people from other parts of China. They don't have to just to sell, you know, this dirty fossil fuel to other provinces or other countries to make money.
Thank you, Tom, for describing so vividly what feels like a really beautiful and exciting future. And it feels so good to listen to that. I'm sure the whole world, everybody is going to be watching what happens next in the next 10 years. That's not so long. 2030 is not so far away. In your story, you allude to the future. The main character is a young woman from girlhood to her marriage and to her becoming a farmer. And of course, you wrote this story before the pledge came for 2030 and 2060, but it's almost as though you were seeing or sensing this already in your story. And I don't know if you agree with me, Tom, but I feel like that's part of the power of stories. What do you think?
Absolutely, I do agree. I think the most powerful thing about storytelling is that we're not just reading out dry data. It's not just about GDP, economy. It's not about policies. It's not about, you know, like money. It's about people's emotions. It's about love or sometimes death. It's about sadness. It's about happiness. And those are the things that no matter where one is from, we all share those emotions. That's why sometimes some dry kind of climate or coal economy or industry stories need to be put on a different shape or package and show really, I mean, dive deeply and go into real people's lives. Because with any kind of macro policy, big change in the world, the most real thing is actually how one individual either changes the life for better or for the worse. I think through storytelling, we can either empower people and tell them that a bright future and a safe climate future is possible, or we can empower them and say, you have the power, you can change what the policymakers are thinking. You can change your lifestyle as well. So there's a lot of potential for public engagement when we do very good climate storytelling.
Thank you. As you did, Tom, in Full Moon, which will come out in the forthcoming Agam anthology, I'm going to ask you to recall, if you can, the photo that was sent to you as a writing prompt. It shows a woman sitting alone in a train station. She's sitting on the ground of the platform and there's no one else around her and a moon is hanging in the sky. How did that lead you to write the story that you wrote?
Yeah, that's very interesting. As soon as I saw that photo, I knew it was from Thailand. It's one of my favorite countries as well. But what I really felt there was some sense of familiarity, although I knew it was in Thailand. What I actually saw there was the kind of full moon I grew up watching, because when I was a kid, the air was so clear and so clean in the mountains in my hometown. I could always see the full moon. And also, we have so many festivals in China to celebrate the full moon. So yeah, I mean, like, I grew up feeling the full moon, feeling the how mysterious and how powerful a full moon would be.
And I want to ask you now about your own journey as a writer yourself. Can you tell me about your story as a writer? How did it start for you?
It's interesting. I grew up with a lot of cousins. On my mom's side and on my dad's side, altogether, I have, 15 or 17 cousins. So it's a tradition, really, in my hometown that the elder kids would look after the younger ones. So, of course, I was one of the younger ones. However, there were still a few other cousins who were much younger than I was. So I was being taken care of by the elder cousins, but at the same time, I would also take care of the younger cousins. And we would just all be growing up together. And also in the 70s, we were quite poor. We didn't really have a lot of toys. Most of the things we had around were just farm animals and some of the butterflies or earthworms, and a few toys we would make with rocks and tree sticks and everything. But that's what we would be doing outside, when the weather was nice. In winter or in summer when it rained, we just had to stay indoors. And that was when we would gather together and tell stories. Some of the elder cousins would share ghost stories or fairy tales that they had heard from their friends or elder people, our parents and stuff. But at the same time, we would just, at least it was my habit at that time, we would just very randomly pick up whatever kind of toys, whatever we had around, we would just try to build a story based on those characters. So it was a lot of fun. And I think it was when my imagination was running the wildest. So I think, yeah, storytelling was a very natural thing for us. And even today, some of my favorite books, for example, The Dreams of the Red Mansion in China, and also The Never Ending Story from Germany, those are some of my favorite books, because I can just lose myself in that kind of fantasy and imagine what the world could be like beyond this reality.
I love The Never Ending Story too.
Yeah.
I've been looking for a copy though, because I don't know where our copy went. And so I need to have it back on our shelves. Anyway, I digress. I love that book. So to continue, in October, you launched Belt and Road Through My Village. Could you tell us what this book is about?
Belt and Road Initiative was launched by China in 2013. And nowadays, 7 years later, or almost 7 years later, it has reached into 188 countries around the world. So we are talking about trillions of dollars of investment. We are talking about billions of people's lives. However, based on my observation and also based on the conversations I've had, this big concept, this huge initiative, have been talked so much by economists, by politicians, by business people, by investors, by journalists. All this kind of talking is mostly about money, is mostly about geopolitical stuff, and mostly about policies. I haven't really heard many stories from those people who live so close to these Belt and Road projects. And in the design of Belt and Road Initiative, people-to-people connectivity is supposed to be one of the five major visions or pillars for the initiative. However, what we hear about most of the time is about money or trade or infrastructure or policy, but we don't really hear about people. And that was when we decided to go into all these different villages in five different countries and interview indigenous people whose lives are being affected or already affected by the Belt and Road projects. The local government and companies don't seem to really communicate enough with the indigenous communities or with these villagers. And of course, Chinese investors and Chinese policymakers are even farther away from them. So it's just not fair for their voices not to be heard by anyone at all. And that is our aim. We want their voices to get a chance to be heard by the international communities, to be heard especially by the Chinese policymakers and investors. And that is why we made the book in seven languages. All the stories are presented in this interviewee's native language. And at the same time, we just translated all the stories into English and Chinese. And we sent copies to the Chinese embassies and Chamber of Commerce so that they could hear directly from these people.
That's amazing. And I hope they do read these stories. If you can, could you share with us maybe one story of one person you spoke to, something that really stayed with you after the interview?
Yeah, many stories. There are so many stories. You know, even 1 year later, I still get goosebumps when I think of these people. For example, the Kaliwa Dam in the Philippines, that's a huge project that has recently started. But already last year, I think in August, I went into the mountains to interview the indigenous communities that were to be affected. More than 300 of them would have to move away from or relocated from the land that their ancestors had left behind for them. These villagers, they have their own language. They don't even speak Tagalog that much. But I remember myself just climbing the mountains with a bag of rice on top of my head, following this indigenous woman to her hometown. Because I was walking faster than a lot of other colleagues, and as well as the journalist I was with. So I was alone there with quite a few indigenous people, and I couldn't really speak their language. They couldn't speak English, but somehow we could communicate. I remember very clearly in the middle of the road, when we were climbing the mountains, she stopped me and pointed at the valley, at the forest far away. And I knew immediately what she was saying was that once the dam is built, all of that place, all the valleys and all the forest will be submerged, will become water. And her house is right there, it's down there. So that was the kind of moment that I just got so touched and determined to help to get these voices out there. Also in Bangladesh, I remember two people so well. One is this 96-year-old fisherman who had lost the house that he had built with his own hands to a coal-fired power plant and had to be moved. And he lost his livelihood as a fisherman because the canal leading towards the sea was blocked by mud from the power plant. And at the same time, he had lost his house. He and his wife, who was also in her late 70s, only had a few chickens, and they just had to walk for miles and miles to sell a few eggs. And that's just so not fair for their life to be so completely turned around. At the same time, in Bangladesh too, in Dhaka, there's a 13-year-old girl who is loving the steady power supply, electricity, because she could study to quite late at night. And she is determined to help her country, and she's determined to become a leader for her country. So those are the kind of stories that we tried to put into the book so that people see what these projects are doing in the coolest way or in the most inspiring way. We also have stories about farmers who in Pakistan who are super excited with the solar park in their village because now they can get electricity, but at the same time, the solar park has connected their village with new roads with other villages so that, you know, like their produce could be sold to much farther places in a more timely manner. So that's the kind of story we have in the book. And I'm really, really excited that we managed to put all of them together. The only thing that was very disappointing to me was with the book launch. Originally, we planned to have offline activities, to have a real activity, to have to go to a gallery and have all these beautiful pictures of the villagers and the indigenous people blown up and hang up in the galleries and invite the indigenous people over to the event so that they can face-to-face tell journalists and tell the Chinese policymakers what their life is like because of Belt and Road projects. However, because of COVID-19 pandemic, we couldn't do that offline event. And at the same time, because there's no internet connection in their villages, in most of these remote communities, they couldn't even be there for the online book launch. So that again, is just another side of how much injustice there is nowadays.
Exactly. Because of limited access that people have to being able to be present online, for example, or even being able to be safe. And in your visits to these villages, what did you observe or what did you sense about how their stories and the changes they're experiencing relate to climate change?
It just made me feel the pain. It's no longer just a word or a number on a piece of paper or in a report. These are the people who hardly ever produce any carbon emission, even going from their village to the market they walk. So these are the most innocent people who have hardly contributed anything to climate change. However, at the same time, they're the most vulnerable communities because with deforestation or with power plant, on the one hand, they don't really enjoy the convenience of this, you know, like coal-fired power. But at the same time, they are being directly victimized with the air pollution.
So when you think about the climate crisis, where does your heart go? Where does your mind go when you think climate crisis?
I think of the same group of people. I think the farmers that I grew up with in my hometown and the villagers I talked to along the Kaliwa Dam are the same people. That's where I am. They are losing their farmland to climate change. In my hometown, when there is a typhoon hitting the Philippines, in my hometown, those farmers are waiting for rain to come down so that their crops could grow. So there is a drought in Shanxi province when all these extreme weather events are showing up in different shapes and in different forms. The victims are the same people. They are the people with hardly any emission. And that's where I am. My organization is called People of Asia for Climate Solutions. And that's where we are. We are with people, but also at the same time, we want people to be empowered enough to push for those solutions. This solution could be renewable energy. These solutions could be low carbon lifestyle change, a lot of different things. These solutions could also be just awareness building. So yeah, I think that's pretty much, you know, like right between the typhoon here in the Philippines and the drought in my hometown, that's where I am, right between the cause of climate change and the solutions of climate change and the people who must be empowered to push for the change.
And how is writing or telling stories or even art playing a role in that space? Does writing occupy that space with you in between the causes and the possible solutions?
Absolutely. I think it should play a bigger role nowadays. Again, just because climate is not just a few number here and there. It's when you talk about 1.5 degree temperature rise or 2 degree temperature rise, people in the quite rich countries, especially Europe and North America, they don't know the difference. However, if we tell a story of whether or not this village would ever exist because of this 0.5 degree temperature difference, that would be a story that's compelling enough for people in Europe and in America to call for stronger climate actions and also to change their lifestyles. So I think the story has the beautiful power of intriguing and provoking people's emotions before their rational thinking. And emotions are sometimes, to a lot of people, way more effective to lead to a change of life or their decision whether or not they should take any action.
Speaking of the provocative power of storytelling, Tom, you were involved in a project that I loved very much during the pandemic, and it was the Journal of a Wuhan Mother Under Lockdown, if I remember the title correctly. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it's called A Wuhan Mother's Journal in Lockdown.
What led you to start that with your friends?
This is a former colleague from Greenpeace, and she lives in Wuhan. And when COVID-19 first started in Wuhan, the whole city, I mean, at that time I was in China celebrating Chinese New Year or Spring Festival with my mom in Shanxi province. And I was already in conversation with my friend almost every day because we all wanted to know quite a few different things. One, whether she was safe and her family was safe, how they were managing to protect themselves, because at that time we were all concerned that they didn't even have enough facial masks, or to be very honest, we didn't even know whether they could get enough food, because prices of vegetables and meat and like rice were getting very high. And despite that, probably even when they could afford it, there probably wasn't enough food around. So we were really concerned about their safety and about, you know, like how they could manage the situation. But then later on, when I came back to Manila, in the middle of our conversation, she started to tell very happy stories about her little girl, a 9-year-old little girl, how this 9-year-old girl was coping with lockdown in a very, very positive way. And that just reminded me of so many of the stories from the Second World War and all the other, you know, like disasters, really. It seems when we are faced with such a huge threat, we don't really have any option but to face the challenge with positivity. And I just started to encourage her to write down these stories for two reasons. One was as almost a therapeutical kind of treatment for herself and her family. And two, I just thought her family's, especially this little girl's positive energy, could get hurt by more of the world that was also, you know, like right after Wuhan getting into pandemic lockdown. So I think this little girl's positive energy could be such an inspiration for the rest of the world. I hope it really worked. I mean, like, I'm really happy people enjoyed reading the stories.
It was really helpful for me as a mother as well. And I would read her entries and I felt like her fear was my fear, but also I could share her small victories at home when she cooked the meal and everybody loved it, or something simple like that. And it just felt good. It's almost as if somebody who went ahead, who walked down that road ahead of us, was shining a light back for us so that we could walk down it as well. That's what it felt like reading her daily entries. And then, of course, there was also a lot to laugh about. So it was a gift to have that lightness as well. And I believe that her writing is still available on Facebook. People can still go and check it out and read what she wrote about their time under lockdown.
Yeah, it is. It's still on Facebook, on that page. I'm really, really happy to hear that, because that's exactly what we were trying to achieve, you know, like her experience as some of the earliest victims to COVID-19 and still trying to stay happy, trying to encourage her little girl to hold on to hope. So I think we need those kind of stories because, you know, like hope is pretty much all that we have.
We do. We need to hold on to that.
Yeah.
Thank you, Tom. It's been really lovely talking to you and listening to all your stories. Thank you for all that you shared today.
Of course. Thank you so much, Padma. And also, Agam, this has been a great experience and such an honor.
Thank you for listening. Agam, the Climate Podcast is produced by the Institute for Climate and Sustainable Cities and Ground Bravo Studios, with music by Rohan Remando. Follow Agam the Climate Podcast on Spotify, Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts. To learn more about our creative collaborations and our forthcoming anthology of climate literature from the Global South, visit our website agam.ph. That's agam.ph. You can also engage with Agam Agenda on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook.